and the council members, there are matters that falls under regulations, but it's good that we get the whole picture in terms of the responses. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and apologies from the DG who's and the minister. They are out on a roadshow, so you know, we have a revolving matter.
The road is in good condition.
I hope so. So today I'm also here as acting DG, so representing the boss. Chair, no, I think, no, thank you for the hearings. I think, as you know, it's been a pretty tough MTBPS. I think certainly just having looked at the hearings and the inputs, we've considered a lot of the inputs. I think we'll try and respond today to all the comments that have been received, obviously in a consolidated way. But Ian, who's the acting DDG for the budget office, Chris and Deborah. Okay, we're together here with us. But let Ian start the show, but I just want to make the point. I think our biggest problem and challenge is the persistently low growth of the last few years. And how do we actually get faster and more inclusive growth? Sitting, I think, in a recession currently, you know, all the metrics are going to go south unless there's going to be significant, unless we're going to get that growth rate up. But then you want to take over, you've got the formula for it.
Okay, thank you, Mama, and thank you, everyone, and thanks for the opportunity. We've had a lot of very interesting inputs, and I think what's striking is how, in some cases, how opposed these inputs are, these strong views on whether the deficit should be wider or narrower, strong views on whether we're spending too much or too little, and I think that points to the difficulties we face, and I bring us back to the title of the MTBPS, which is to say we're at a crossroads. We believe strongly we are at a crossroads, and that crossroads represents many difficult choices that we'll have to take. And one of those difficult choices is how, for example, we manage the state-owned company sector over the next few years. Another difficult choice is around how to manage the growth of the wage bill over the medium term. And I think another crossroads is around the implementation of long outstanding growth reforms and how quickly we can move on those. And the point we wanted to make is that our main challenge remains persistently low economic growth. There's a tendency to try to fix all of these things through the fiscal framework. Our view is that isn't the case. The fiscal framework can obviously play an enabling role, or it can play a dampening role on the general economy. But in broad terms, if you want higher long-term or potential GDP growth, you need to implement growth reforms. And so the MTBPS, in a sense, was not so much a fiscal story. The MTBPS was talking about growth, was talking about the requirement to strengthen governance, stamp out waste and corruption, and turn around key state institutions. And we believe that is what is required for economic development going forward. The other point we wanted to make in the book is that we've had many years of fiscal consolidation, and in our view, we're running out of space for additional tax increases, spending cuts, and reprioritization. And certainly, it doesn't mean it cannot be done, but our view is it needs to be done in a very careful way because the economy is currently in a technical recession, and we've tried to avoid as far as possible additional fiscal measures that would keep the economy in recession for longer. We've also tried as far as possible, you know, since the introduction of the spending ceiling in 2012, to protect frontline services like health and education and infrastructure budgets. And even there, at the end of last year, and coming into the budget from this year in February, there were reductions to some conditional infrastructure grants. And over the long term, if you're going to cut on infrastructure without managing your current expenditures, you're going to harm growth and development. So what we've said is it's going to be increasingly difficult for government to do across-the-board expenditure reductions, as we've seen in the past. And again, tough decisions are required around specific programs and efficiencies in specific programs and what our priorities are in expenditure over the coming years, including around state-owned companies. So we've also raised taxes substantially over the past 5 years, and what we've seen actually are increasingly large under-collections as the economy slows down. And that is despite increases in personal income tax, value-added tax, ad valorem duties, the fuel levy, dividends tax, and capital gains tax. We've tried a broad mix. We've tried to target the upper end of the income distribution, but it's clear that personal income tax in particular has been falling short in recent years. So, again, you know, if you're in a period of low economic growth and rising administered prices in particular, South African households are under a lot of pressure, unemployment is rising, electricity tariffs are under pressure, water tariffs are under pressure. We want to avoid as far as possible putting additional pressure on the economy through the fiscal framework. However, having said that, additional fiscal measures may be required in the budget next year if we haven't made sufficient progress on the reform agenda that is outlined and we feel that we are now on an unsustainable path. And in particular, if we want to protect the expenditure ceiling, which is our main fiscal anchor, we will have to have made progress on both state-owned companies and the wage bill. Okay, so now I'm going to go to some of the general questions and comments that were put to us. There's been a general discussion around the credibility of South Africa's and specifically National Treasury's growth forecasts. And I just want to make a few points on this because in our view, our forecasts are credible and certainly in line with what you're seeing across the private sector and in multilateral development banks. The issue really is about certainly during the boom we saw, we were typically rather pessimistic in the mid-2000s, and since the recession in 2009-10, there's been an optimism bias, but this is by no means an issue unique to National Treasury, and I'll try to explain that now. So here we've got the market consensus for 2009 to 2018. The simple point we wanted to make is that, you know, at the beginning of 2009, let's put it differently, in 2007 the market was predicting 5% real GDP growth in 2009, and then ultimately, of course, it came in as a recession. And the general trend over time has been that the market consensus forecast is relatively high and then has to be revised down over time. And if you compare the National Treasury to other forecasters, you get the following. So this is what those graphs show. It's the root mean square error, but basically what it is an estimate of the errors in our forecast. On the left is in the current year, and on the right hand side of the graph is the year ahead forecast. And the point we wanted to make again is that Treasury is by no means out of line or more optimistic or outside of either Reuters consensus, which surveys many economists and companies, the Bloomberg consensus, BER, IMF, and others. And in fact, if you look at what the research is saying, there have been several studies that found that National Treasury forecasts were on par with or better than market projections, including Fund of Us 2013, the PBO 2016, and Barclays 2017. So, you know, for us, it's really very important that the credibility of our forecasts stand. We believe we are absolutely in line with or better than existing forecast estimates. And I've put here the most recent numbers. Ironically, you know, it depends who you talk to. On the roadshow, we were criticized by some for being too pessimistic on the growth numbers, and others were arguing that we're too optimistic. And I think this again points to the extremely high level of uncertainty around the growth outlook of the economy. But National Treasury 0.7, 1.7, and 2.1 is very much in line with a whole host of other reputable institutions. Okay, a lot of the conversation then turned to what is the fiscal stance, what is the role of the fiscus in the current environment, this graph you may have seen before, we have presented it, but I'll just make a key point again. The difficulty is that we're trying to tread a tightrope here for the National Treasury and this government between a fiscal stance that is too contractionary and harmful to growth and one that is too expansionary and is not going to stabilize debt over the longer term. And the problem is that as your economy slows down, of course, there's pressure to increase taxes and reduce spending. And in a sense, that can harm growth and tax revenue over time and result in a wider budget deficit. So what we are trying to avoid is to get into a debt trap where the fiscal decisions we take actually result in lower growth and lower revenue and require, again, additional fiscal measures. And this is a very difficult balancing act, and we've argued over the past 6 years for a measured consolidation that both stabilizes debt but allows for real growth in expenditure, particularly on frontline services, and doesn't put too much pressure on the economy. And, you know, we obviously, I just bring us back to this graph on the left. The graph on the left shows us revenue as a percentage of GDP and non-interest expenditure as a percentage of GDP. As you can see, that around the 2009-10 recession, global recession, we had a very sharp drop-off in revenue and at the same time a sharp spike in expenditure. And in a sense, the fiscal stance at that moment was strongly counter-cyclical. But part of the issue there is that it was strongly counter-cyclical because wages in particular were rising. And that is a structural increase in expenditure. And an economist will tell you that a stimulus should be timely, temporary, targeted. If you're going to have structural increases in expenditure, it means, yes, it's supportive of the economy, it is counter-cyclical, but over time you can see that the level of expenditure has remained broadly unchanged as a share of GDP. That has basically been due to the efforts of the expenditure ceiling, and at the same time we've been raising taxes, and the black line has been rising over time. And as you can see, we almost achieved the primary balance around 2015-16, which would have, of course, helped us to stabilize debt and bring it down over time. That is what is required. If you want to stabilize debt, the black line needs to cross the red line. We almost achieved that, and then we've been hit by 2 years of subpar growth and significant revenue shortfalls. And again, we're in a phase where we're projecting a slow but steady a narrowing of the primary balance over the next 3 years. The other point to make is that on the right-hand side, we've got non-interest spending growing in real terms. So in a sense, we do still provide some support to the economy, and particularly we've tried to target frontline services. So again, we're trying to balance competing objectives in a way that neither harms the economy too much and doesn't allow debt to grow in an uncontrolled fashion. But our options are becoming increasingly limited, and hence the MTBPS's call again that focus be on growth reforms, governance reforms, and financial management rather than specifically trying to fix these through the fiscal framework. One of the questions that has come up quite a bit is, should South Africa not consider additional fiscal anchors? In other words, is the expenditure ceiling sufficient, or do we need a debt-to-GDP, for example, a debt-to-GDP rule in addition to the ceiling? Now, we are certainly looking and thinking about all of these elements, and I think, you know, we stated again in the speech that we're going to look at additional fiscal anchors, and we'll be working on those and thinking those through over the coming months. But I just wanted to make one or two points. The first is a quote from Ostri, which says, "What constitutes a safe level of debt is, needless to say, very difficult to pin down precisely in practice and can never be established through some mechanical rule or threshold." I would argue that, you know, the same holds for the optimal level of debt. There's been a lot of uncertainty about how much debt a country can hold. What is the relationship between debt and growth has also been an area of serious contention in the academic literature. The answer really is that you're sustainable until you're not, and what you need is a fiscal framework that gives you the room to absorb fiscal shocks. And so when Saxegaard wrote a paper in 2014, he came to the conclusion that South Africa's debt ceiling is around 60% of GDP, although uncertainty is very high. and his simulations suggest that targeting a debt-to-GDP ratio of 40% allows South Africa to remain below the ceiling over the medium term with a high degree of confidence. So he was trying to make the point that South Africa, if you look at what happened in 2009-10...
Can you know, Ian, forget that I'm so slow in appreciating. No, speak so fast that I lose everything.
Okay. Must I slow down a bit? Or? Okay. Apologies. Okay. Okay. So Chair, the point, I think the point is this, that it's very hard to say there's an optimal level or a specific level at which we're no longer sustainable. What we can say is that governments that have a high level of foreign debt and governments that have a high level of short-term debt tend to get into trouble. And luckily our debt management strategy is fairly conservative. We've got a very long tenure on our debt. You know, we do pay for that because it means we have to issue long term, and that means our debt service costs are slightly higher, but the argument is that's a form of insurance. So we pay slightly higher to issue long term debt, but it means that we don't have to roll over the debt as often. And then the other major decision we've taken, of course, over the years is not to issue more than 10% of our debt in foreign currency, and that has helped us a lot. I mean, Chair, there's been basically an emerging market crisis going on out this year. Turkey and Argentina, of course, amongst others. And we have actually come through that emerging market crisis in fairly good shape, but we didn't escape unscathed. So the rand has fallen by almost 20% since the beginning of the year, and the yields on our debt have gone up by between 100 and 200 basis points. And an economist will tell you that those kind of movements in the exchange rate and in your bond yields are typically associated with like fiscal crisis in other countries, and we're not in that position. And I think that owes a lot to our strong institutions, to our inflation targeting regime, to our floating exchange rate, and our conservative debt strategy. But the point I think that Saxegaard makes in his paper, and that paper goes into a whole lot of different measures of what is optimal debt, what is sustainable, what isn't. The point he tries to make is you can't be sure, but you want to build buffers into the system. And once you get to 60% debt to GDP, those buffers are going to be much, much smaller. And so he talks about targeting 40% over the longer term. But I want to add three other points, which is to say, and I've highlighted it there, any fiscal anchor is only as good as a government's ability to manage fiscal pressures. So, yes, we don't think that the fiscal numbers are ideal, but they are credible, and we believe that the spending and the revenue numbers are achievable. If we are going to implement something like a debt ceiling without coming to terms with and solving the underlying expenditure pressures, including the wage bill and state-owned companies, then in fact a debt ceiling can harm your credibility if you're implementing new rules that haven't addressed the underlying pressures. So we are certainly open to a discussion on this. We are thinking about it a lot, but we maintain that you have to deal with the composition of spending over time and make policy decisions on issues like the future of a state-owned company. Okay, then I want to move on a little bit about, and just Chair, and for the committee, I thought it would be useful to give you a sense of what national and provincial government is spending on in broad terms, and also to give you a sense of why it becomes increasingly difficult over time to reduce the expenditure ceiling. So we've got this table here, which it looks like it's got a lot of numbers in it, but what it is trying to show you, if you look at just the 2018-19 year, for example, that's the year in the middle, you can see that in 2016 we forecast that the ceiling would be 1.32 trillion, and by the time we get to the 2018 MTBPS, which is the last row, we're at 1.314 trillion, and that is really the story. So the expenditure ceiling has been revised down. If you look at next year, it was initially set at around 1.43 trillion, it's now at about 1.41 trillion. And so Treasury has been trying to manage the fiscal pressures by revising down the ceiling, but still allowing expenditure growth over time. And that, again, is the kind of tightrope the balancing act or the measured consolidation that we've been talking about. And in addition to that, we've already done a lot of reprioritization. So at the time of the budget, there were big baseline cuts for most departments, and almost all of that was reprioritized towards fee-free higher education. And similarly, in this MPBS, we did another 32 billion rand of reprioritization. So our view is we are, the degrees of freedom are becoming fewer over time. If you look at this table, again, this is a lot, but I think it's important just to understand, broadly speaking, what is consolidated national provincial government spending look like by economic classification. And we're saying that, in broad terms, about 58% is current payments. And, of course, the big majority there is compensation of employees. And then there's a whole another large area of spending which is covered by transfers and subsidies, and I'll talk to those in a moment. But under there is everything from your departmental agencies, so NSFAS will be in there, your foreign, your international organization transfers, households, which is basically social grant payments, higher education institutions, non-profit institutions, and so on. And then we've got payment for capital assets, which is effectively the infrastructure build program. And that is, in broad brushstrokes, what is in the budget. And if you start drilling down into that, you'll see that the pressures, again, are rising, because we have compensation of employees, first of all. The MPBPS states that we took a decision to say the new wage agreement will be funded within existing baselines. There were some questions about what does that mean. Well, it means that over the lifespan of the wage agreement, we think the additional cost is 30 billion. So it's for the year 2018, 2019, and 2020, which is when the wage agreement comes to an end. So it's for the lifespan. So it's about, you know, 8 to 10 billion a year in pressure on a national provincial wage bill of around 1.8 trillion over that time period. So yes, it is additional pressure, and certainly We've also tried to make the point that the pressures are not evenly distributed. The major pressures are defense and police at national level, and at provincial levels in health and education. Goods and services. Goods and services, what is actually in goods and services? Again, I won't belabor these points, but I think for the committee, just to understand, roughly half of goods and services accounted for by the big six items, and that includes property payments, purchase of medicine, road maintenance, operating leases, outsourced services, and computer services. And again, you know, our view is not a lot of space to do across-the-board cuts on goods and services, because that is the area that has taken the vast majority of the reductions over the past 5 years. And then, of course, payments for capital assets, we'd like to protect that, because infrastructure investment is very important for long-term growth and development. Transfers and subsidies, I think, is an area that we need to start looking at in more detail, because it's got a lot of different entities are in there, as I've already mentioned, and the transfers to entities over the next 3 years is almost 480 billion, and of course they also have their own revenue in some cases. And about 213 billion will be spent on compensation in the public entity space, and around 320 billion on goods and services. So we think if there's anywhere to look again, it is probably around the transfers to public entities, and the other transfers to corporations, for example. But again, the transfers for public corporations, basically, the vast majority there are transfers to PRASA and some to ESCOM around the INET, the infrastructure rollout program. And then transfers to private enterprises, giving a sense of what it's going to. A lot goes to, for example, bus subsidies for scholar transport, and then various private sector incentives. So you can see that overall, across the board, cuts are going to be very difficult, because there are a lot of very important spending line items in here, and we're reiterating this point that actually decisions are going to have to be made about what we prioritize and which programs, for example, should be closed or ramped up, rather than across-the-board cuts in future. There were many discussions about compensation, and we just want to make two simple points. The first is, I think the way the information has been reported has sometimes been obscured just a basic fact that we're trying to get across, and it's just arithmetic. Compensation of employees has grown by 11% per annum over the past decade or so, while goods and services has grown by about 8% and payments of capital assets by about 10%. And the simple point we want to make is if one area of spending grows faster than all the other areas of spending, over time you're going to crowd out everything. You're going to crowd out those areas that are growing more slowly. And that's a simple, it's a simple arithmetic, and it's clear that, if this is the way that we want to go in future, that should be done in a conscious way rather than the composition of spending worsening over time. And our view is that if you look at why is the case that compensation continues to grow so quickly, this comes from the back of the MTBPS. We did a breakdown of what has been driving compensation growth. And you can see that aggregate, this is public service, so this is national provincial wage bill, was 154 billion in 2006-07. That's the red block on the left. And last year, aggregate compensation for national and provincial departments came to about 480 billion, which is a substantial increase, even taking into account the effect of inflation. And that's the point we want to make here. So the big story is that salaries have increased substantially, and that civil servants are being paid substantially more in real terms than they were a decade ago. And the increase in headcount is a relatively small driver of the overall wage bill. And I think this was the point made by several of the, in some of the public comments we received on MTBPS. So we also note that there's quite substantial turnover in the public service, with as many as 6% of personnel leaving in a given year. And I think that what these numbers show, they start to point a way forward on how we can think about the wage bill going forward. I mean, the issue is basically around automatic cost pressures in the system rather than headcount specifically. And it seems, I think, again, this is something that DPSA will have to take the lead on, but one of the things that we'll probably have to look at is the OSDs, the occupation-specific dispensation, because part of the OSD change implies faster automatic notch increment growth. And so it seems to us that that's one area that should be looked at. And another way of managing the wage bill is looking at the rates of turnover and natural attrition in the public service. Another finding was that the average age of the public service has gone up quite substantially in the past 10 years, which suggests that something like voluntary early retirement could have an impact. On state-owned companies, we were asked a few questions about what does Treasury foresee, what is our plan for the state-owned companies. Again, the Department of Public Enterprises would have to take the lead, but we are closely involved, and I wanted to give you a sense of some of the work that's going on. The first thing we wanted to say in the MTBPS is that these issues of governance, financial management, and growth are very heavily interlinked. So I keep coming back to the ESCOM example. If you want, for example, to promote private investment in the energy sector, if you want to take the pressure off households by having lower administered prices, and if you want to reduce the contingent liabilities on the fiscus, all of those come back to a reform of the electricity sector and ESCOM. And again, we are heavily involved, but this needs to be a government-wide effort. DPE, Energy Planning, Monitoring, Evaluation, and Treasury are working together at the moment on various options around restructuring the electricity sector. ESCOM has come out and said they're going to be presenting their views on this during November. Step one has been around stabilization of the governance at ESCOM, which is underway. And step two is looking at the sector in general, around security of supply, lower costs, about the different roles of generation, transmission, and distribution. And, you know, the minister has also been quite vocal about this, saying we should look at options like separation, at least separating transmission from generation. And so, again, the point we want to make is that reform of the electricity sector is really at the heart of what we're going to have to do, and one of the major areas that is required over the medium term to not only boost growth and investment, but also take pressure off South African households. I'm now going to hand over to Chris to respond to specific questions that were raised around taxes, and then I'll come back to Klaus.
Good morning, Richard. Good morning, honourable members. I'm not going to interject at any point, I'm sure.
Order. Welcome to the inputs from members. Please proceed. You are protected.
thank you.
No, it's not a minister. He's an official.
So the comments on the zero rating, there were a lot of comments made. The zero rating of sanitary pads, cake flour, and bread flour was welcomed by most of the submissions. There were comments made that more items should have been zero rated and should have been considered, as well as that there should be more targeted expenditure programs, such as for vouchers for school uniforms, as well as there were comments on local poultry, as well as on reductions in tariffs for electricity and water. The independent panel did this report. We were very worried about the impact of the VAT increase. That independent panel was convened. They did a lot of analytical work, and in the end, they recommended that 6 items be considered. So this is now zero rating 3 of those 6 items. But given the very large revenue shortfalls and, you know, our need to try and ensure the integrity of the VAT system, you know, the MTVPS proposes that half of those items are zero rated. The more and more we zero rate, the more revenue we would lose. In effect, to get that money back, you would eventually need a higher VAT rate. So we are very worried about the fiscal position, as the start of the presentation did show. I mean, after 5 years of significant increases in taxes and large revenue shortfalls, you know, we do still believe that the VAT increase was necessary to ensure that our public finances are sustainable. And we just would also like to highlight that, you know, recent studies that have been shown, that have done by, including by members of that same independent panel of experts and by the World Bank, has shown that VAT in South Africa is not regressive because of the zero-rated items, because they are well-targeted. But we are very well aware that it does increase the cost of living for even the poorest households. We are painfully aware of that fact, and believe that more effective and targeted government expenditure is really needed to alleviate the burden and the impact of this. So we are considering better monitoring and compliance expenditure mechanisms to get better targeting. And the NGO input on this has been very insightful. I would like to just make, you know, one comment by one of the NGOs at the public hearing was, you know, did you not welcome that sanitary pads and others were zero rated? And they did say, yes, we do welcome the zero rating. However, that's not enough because it doesn't solve the problem of affordability, and you need targeted expenditure programs in order to help lower income households. And I think that comment from the NGO is exactly in line with what our thinking is. A lot of money, if you do zero rate, a lot of money that is lost in revenue forgone goes to households on higher incomes. And that's not an effective use of public resources. But targeted expenditure wouldn't have those leakages. Mohamed, do you want to add on that one?
So, Chair, I think there's an important point, and perhaps something we really do need to look into, because obviously, formally we have the systems to check for efficient expenditure, but we know that there's a lot of waste, there's a lot of corruption, a lot of middle persons perhaps who take the money rather than it actually going to poor households. Now, some expenditure programs like grants, we know they actually go to the beneficiaries and they get the whole amount. Yes, there too there's issues of people trying to make deductions and so on. So that's say, one area when you deal with grants. Then let's take a program like the school feeding scheme. Look, none of us actually deal with the expenditure issues, but the issue is, how can we ensure that it happens every day? How can we ensure that it's also done first thing in the morning, okay, and not middle of the day? How do we know that kids are actually getting it, okay? And because the audit processes and so on are too late, and are there not better mechanisms to check? I mean, we don't have the answers, but I think perhaps the way forward here is to look at a couple of these programs and to say these will have a bigger impact on dealing with poverty and poor households, and can we put better mechanisms to actually make sure the spending happens quickly and more effectively? Then what other programs could there be? I think the point was made that within the expenditure ceiling, can we certainly, as we go towards the budget, look at some programs? Some of them may well be currently funded, and just given the system we have, some will be done by provinces, as you know. So if it's a school feeding scheme, it's going to be done through provincial education budgets. That's the way you reach the poor. Okay. Obviously, there are children who don't go to school. It gets to the early childhood development phase. And what are the mechanisms to feed kids who go to those schools? Okay. Similarly, other provisions that people have talked about may relate to municipal services. So if you look at the provision and subsidies we have for basic electricity, water, etc., that is done through municipalities. Obviously, that implies that you are connected to municipal systems. If you're not, and you live in an informal dwelling, you may or may not get it. So we don't have the answers, Chair, but I'm saying that I do think we need to look in a more concerted way in here about how are these programs actually working, and perhaps as a way forward to outline some of these programs and have some independent mechanisms that can check, whether it's done through the FFC or, you know, or some sort of inspectors that we set up. But unless we do that, I don't think we're going to solve this problem of targeting poor households as effectively as we would like. So that's just some of the thinking that we have, Chair.
The next point on the VAT refund. So we had quite a few questions to say, basically, did this problem about VAT refunds, where the estimate has been revised up by 20%, 20 billion, basically undo the increase in the VAT rate? So the estimated amount of VAT refund was revised up by 20 billion. Page 21 of the MCCVS tries to go into this detail, but 9 billion of that is a revision in our own estimates. It's the 11 billion that is an additional amount to clear the backlog. So it's 11 billion that is the pivotal figure here. So it is correct to say that, in effect, the revenues this year will be 11 billion lower than they should have been because we are paying out the backlog of VAT refunds. But it's not as if that is a loss of revenue. In effect, this is a timing issue. So in the previous years, revenues were 11 billion higher, but now they'll be 11 billion lower in this year. So, you know, we don't think it's correct to associate this VAT refund payout with saying that half of the VAT increase is then null and void. It really is just a timing issue, but it will have this one-off impact this year, but that will fall away from next year. The 9 billion is a revision in our estimate of the VAT refund, and that does flow through to the outer years. We did get a lot of comments from commentators on other general tax policy measures. So, for example, to reduce the deficit or to even potentially reverse the VAT rate, we should have looked at increasing the CIT rate from, say, 28% to 32%. We should look at increasing a new wealth tax. We should look at much higher and more progressive taxes on personal income, for example, a 50 or 55% rate on the top. And we must do a lot more to make the tax system more progressive. So these are all considerations that we take into account each year. At the NTVPX, we usually don't make large tax policy announcements. This year, we did make the announcement on the zero rating. But all of those submissions do go into our considerations. We then discuss those with the Minister of Finance, and we try and make those large tax policy announcements, but only in the budget of each year. So those will be considered. Those are put into our discussions, and we will discuss it with the Minister. The next point was on the tax avoidance. So there was comments saying we don't focus enough on tax avoidance and evasion in the NTVPS. We just wanted to provide a quick update here. So we are part of the G20 OECD Action Plan on Wage Erosion and Profit Shifting. It has 15 action items that countries involved in this process are trying to address. Some of those include the digital economy, harmful tax practices, controlled foreign company rules, interest deductions, treaty abuse, transfer pricing, etc. In page 137 of the 2017 budget review, so that's last year, we had a long breakdown of each of these action items and the progress and the measures that we are taking to address those. So for example, that continues each year. In the NTVPS, in this event, we actually publish regulations covering a broader range of foreign electronic services, so to include them into the VAT net. So it expands the VAT base, and this was actually published alongside the medium-term budget policy statements on our website. So this is sort of a direct measure to, which is part of Action 1 in these 15 action items, which is on the digital economy. SARS has also been receiving information on multinational organizations through country-by-country reporting. That has started from June this year. So a lot of that information on multinationals, how they set up, how the flows work, is flowing through to SARS. We've had legislation last year and this year on measures to counter tax avoidance through share buybacks as well as through dividend stripping, and that continues. Just to note, having a little punt at ourselves, but South Africa's controlled foreign company rules have actually been internationally acknowledged as being very well designed and were recommended to other countries as one of three options for them to implement. Ours are already in place. And we were also one of the first countries to sign a multilateral convention to implement tax treaty-related measures to prevent base erosion and profit shifting. So it's a multilateral instrument, which means that we can very quickly adjust treaties with other countries if there are seen to be harmful tax practices in those treaties. That was signed in June 2017. So we continue to work on that, and we can provide further updates to this committee as and when it happens.
And Chair, I mean, just to make the point, obviously, I think that there's been a lot of discussions with SARS, not just to improve their capacity, but there's no doubt, if one reads the Nugan report, the interim report, that there certainly were, we went backwards, okay, and some things clearly need to be fixed. And I'm sure you would have heard that there was a significant announcement last night by the President to give effect to Judge Nugan's recommendation. So those are, sorry? Oh, okay. So I'm just notifying you what's in the
order.
News.
Order. Momo, carry on.
I think before I just get to the next slide, Chris will talk through, because I think, you know, that kind of capacity issue also relates to customs and excise, and just fixing up that unit. And you know, it's been interesting to see these big adverts by the big tobacco producers that we could get $7 billion. Quite skeptical that they are more interested in giving us the revenue. I think we want to make sure people don't smoke, whether it's big tobacco or small tobacco. And I think there's issues between big versus small tobacco. There's been all the issues of illicit tobacco, which clearly is something that SARS needs to act on, because there too, the capacity, and if you again follow the Nugan Commission, the hearings, clearly there are big issues there of perhaps not doing this job quite deliberately. In the budget, in fact, an engagement that we have is also whether, how do we put it, a minimum price, which I know the Department of Health, we're trying to engage with them, because your big problem is you've got very cheap cigarettes. The first issue is whether they pay the excise, okay? But even if they paid the excise, it would still be significantly cheaper. And the best way to discourage smoking is to make sure the price goes up, as we did with the sugar beverage and so on. So I think that there are those challenges that also need to be looked at. But do you want to just talk about the specifics of the illicit tobacco?
Thanks, Mama. Yeah, so, I mean, there was a presentation that was made to the committee, basically showing, you know, some other countries, for example, Poland, Malaysia, where there were these large increases in excise duties, and then they say that led to an increase in illicit trade and a reduction in revenues. Yeah, so in our view, it's actually quite clear that illicit trade has increased. I mean, you look at our revenues, it's clear that, you know, almost dropped by 25% within 1 year. It's clear that there are problems there in terms of revenue collection. But in terms of our policy, we've got a very stable policy on tobacco excise duties. You know, we have 40%, we target 40% of the average weighted retail selling price. So it's the same amount. It does usually increase by slightly more than inflation, but that's just because people are moving to higher value products, or the ones that are not illicit. So we've got a very stable policy. We haven't had this large increase in excise duties over the last 4 or 5 years. And yet we've had this very large increase in illicit trade. So for the respondents or the people who came to present to you to say, no, we must either freeze or decrease the excise duty in order to stop the illicit trade, you know, we don't think it was the increase in the excise duty that led to the illicit trade. It's a problem with enforcement. So we don't think that freezing or lowering will help the illicit trade problem at all. It really is, in our view, an enforcement problem. The Nugent Commission has showed that not enough attention has been paid in this space, and we need to work on that. We don't think lowering the taxes in this environment is a reason to try and reduce illicit trade. The next point was just on land taxes. I thought we would try and give a more comprehensive response because the institution that comes to present to this committee, they do come twice a year, I think. So we did try and give more comprehensive response in the rates bill, but we'll try and give more here. So the view is that, you know, the Constitution requires that taxing power is not used in economically destructive ways, and income taxes and value-added taxes create large state-based losses, and they should be gradually replaced with a land tax, which are not as harmful and they do not distort economic activity. That statement, we actually do generally agree with that. A lot of the OECD report shows that land taxes are a more efficient type of taxation than others. It's an immobile form of capital, so then it can also increase in value due to public expenditures which improve nearby infrastructure. So there are a lot of good economic arguments for this. But the Davis Tax Committee did also raise some valid concerns, and they are concerns that we share as well. So the one is it creates, in terms of this view where you get rid of all other taxes and only have a land tax, you know, you create a much less diversified tax base. If land property values were to decrease, suddenly all your revenues are in dire danger. You know, and it creates a problem with buoyancy over the cycle. So you need a diversified tax base, which is what we have, that we tax a lot of different types of income and consumption. It also does create cash flow issues. If someone's sitting on the land but they've got no actual income, how can they pay for this tax? That could potentially be dealt with, but it is an issue they need. I think the one that's most concerning for us is if you only had a land tax, in effect you could make your system a lot less progressive. If you had a tech entrepreneur that had made billions from a sound investment or from a new investment or a new business that they had, and yet they owned not very much land, all of that would be tax-free. Would you not tax a 40 billion rand share incentive? Would you not tax billions in income? You know, the progressivity issues there are difficult to overcome. Even saying that, though, however, we have been holding and attending workshops to explore this topic, and we think it is a fruitful avenue for research because it is an effective tax. It doesn't mean that it needs to be the only tax, but potentially it could be used more in future. So we're looking at it. It's an interesting area. Not a lot of other countries have done it, but some of the arguments are sound. Shall I pass Ian to you for the conclusion?
Okay, thanks. So, Chair, just to conclude, the point we've been trying to make on the fiscal side is that we continue with what we believe is a tightrope or a difficult balancing act. It's a moderate consolidation over time that supports real expenditure growth while ensuring that debt stabilizes. But we are also saying in the MTBPS that we have raised taxes repeatedly, we've reduced the expenditure ceiling repeatedly, and the options for additional fiscal measures are becoming increasingly limited. We are certainly open to thinking about additional measures or additional anchors for fiscal policy. But the big issue is around the composition of spend over time, and if we're going to introduce any additional anchors, we still have to deal with the underlying issues, which are around pressures from the wage bill in particular and the state-owned company sector. And maybe lastly, just to reiterate the overall story of the MTBPS, which is that the fiscus cannot fix long-term economic growth. What is required are growth reforms, governance reforms, and changes to financial management. Thank you.
You done? Other members, we also received a document by email yesterday, written responses to questions posed during the presentation. Well, they have a lot of rain. I'm looking forward to that in my area. But leave that now. This is not environmental change. This is finance. Yeah, I like it too. You want them to go through this as well? Whoops. The written doctor responses. Fine. Member Mania?
No, is this an opportunity to pose questions? I don't want them to go through. I've read the report.
I'm just going to get some guidance. No. That's what I said in the beginning. There's preparation matters also covered in that document, which is, I'm glad you did. Thank you for that. It gives us the bigger picture. Honourable members, we've got a couple of our stakeholders here. I see OTA is here. COSATU is here. PBO, Parliamentary Budget Office, is here. Are there anyone else that's representing the stakeholders we met on Wednesday? Since only the three of them, you are also welcome to participate. We invited you on Wednesday to come back today. All the members' questions. Honourable Tandy, Honourable Mania, Honourable Terblanche, on the Monarchy, and both Konyen. In that order, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. National Treasury's response is very comprehensive. I never thought you would even go to an extent of wanting to respond to the issue of land, because if you look at that issue of land, it's a very nonsensical argument. Basically, it's an argument that says if somebody stays in the former Transkei and has massive land, but it's got a wrong level on it, you must tax that person for that land, even if they are unemployed, and just stay in a rondavel with grass, and not tax somebody who stays in Constantia with a substantive building that is more valuable, even if it's not, you know, a small piece of land. I didn't think that you would go to that extent. But maybe in future, when things are all good and so on, we might want to think about taxing land. And for now, I know why the argument. The argument is saying, don't tax us, tax those who stay in rondavels with large land. And if you go that route, then I'll be there for you. I didn't want to, you know, I respect old people. The gentleman looks very old, so I did not want to take him on. But, well, you are entitled to look at that. let's look at the issues. You see, I asked PBO a specific question in relation to the wage bill. The picture is that in the provinces, that's where you've got 60% of payments that are made to a very small number of people. And the question I asked was that, is it related to leg promotions? Because you see, in relation to level 1 to 4, there's almost nothing. It's people who start from level 8 to level 12. And now, if you look at the role of the public service in the current conjuncture, you find that the public service is actually contracting consultants in most of its infrastructure projects. It's not necessarily done by the government. So why is it that the wage bill continues to grow at that level when it's not juxtaposed to productivity? And I know it might sound arrogant when you as, I'm not talking to you, shut up. He's very excited that they prepared questions for him, so he wants to ask them as quickly as he can. Now, the issue is, it's going to sound a little bit arrogant when the National Treasury plays a very decisive monitoring role, but I'm saying to you, you the custodians of the fiscal, if you are not going to gain some form of interest as to how the policies that were formulated that gives provincial and local government powers to handle money that come from national government, you will come here and you will be expected to solve a problem that you have never created. Okay? People blame National Treasury for not doing it. And you know, you'll find the situation right here at pains to explain that you need to focus on economic growth and not use the fiscal as a solution and so on. And you'll have people who will say, but why don't you get countercyclical approaches to the fiscal and you're doing fiscal consolidation, as if it's your role to grow the economy as National Treasury. Now, we must go to the chamber and explain this thing. Now, the issue is, we need to be at the point, Chair, where we act, and we act decisively. I've made a suggestion to say, let's put conditions on the grants that we are sending to provinces. If you need to pay directly to a service provider, do that. Don't give it to people whom we know after 5 years will be dealing with state capture here because somebody stole money and gave to their friends. The very same targeted expenditure. You see, let's evaluate it. Let's evaluate whether school feeding schemes have not had problems of people who never gave food to children because they stole the money in one way or the other. Or they charged peanut butter at 50 rand when it costed 20 rand. Okay? And we wait for Governor Shal and his cohort to come and explain to us at the end of the year that it never happened. And they write very strong statements and then it's only those statements. You see, then something must start to happen. You see, but I have always said to Chair, we need to have monitoring tools. 3 years, three months, we see the performance. We need to look at the performance of the very same institutions. And we depend on you because we are in the NSOP is the most powerful tool to do that in provinces. With us, it's very limited, given the program that we have. So we need to look at that. Second thing, the tobacco industry. You see, a gentleman here states as a fact that actually illicit tobacco is manufactured locally. They want to shift the blame to South Africa, that is where. And I have to remind him that I dealt with these things before, in my previous life, and I discovered that actually they came through the borders. And I lament the BMA issue up until it's removed from Home Affairs and it's back to us. I lament it. Because you see, as long as your customs and excise move is not empowered to be able to deal with these issues, you will have scalems. You see, this morning, let me tell you what happened in the radio. They say a taxi that's supposed to carry 16 people was carrying 57 Malawians transported by a Zimbabwean taxi. And the taxi driver was only charged for overload. Right? 57 Malawians in a taxi because they were able to pass through the borders. Now, some people think that a traffic officer's got powers to say, show me your passport. He can't. He say, why are you 57? That's his job. Those ones let them through there all the way there. You see, this is the system that if we were still there, perhaps it would have not happened. I'm now lamenting, Chair, let me move away from lamentation. Then the benchmarking on forecasting. Yeah, at least there was fresh air. I don't know. I'm going to apply my mind. Now you're giving me additional reading. I must go and try to find out what is the global a benchmark on forecasting, whether the ones we have is relevant and so on, because it's a big argument here and so on. And we don't want to be seen to be protecting you on that. That's why every year I raise this thing, because we're trying to test the best models. Everybody thinks that they've got the best models. They think they know it all. But the test is in the pudding, as and when it's implemented. And here the argument has been, global economic growth has been a challenge. There's been a contagion. And people does not want to accept the issues of contagion. I don't know whether because they don't understand economics or because they've got political agendas and so on. They will continuously put it in their own understanding and so on. Where is an issue that will continuously remind people about contagion? I said it on several occasions. The trade war between America and China does not assist smaller developing countries, because there's a spill-off effect on it. And that's one of the hard facts. Chair, I'm trying to wrap up. Let me see. Okay. Now, the last point. You see, Kosatu is here. Smith is not going to be very happy with us. We're saying there's been 11% growth over time of the wage bill. And now we're saying currently it must stay within the expenditure ceiling. These guys are going to issue a statement and say the workers come first and so on. I don't know what are we going to say in terms of moving forward. What can we promise them, Chair? You know, sometimes you just oppose a strong statement with promises. Sometimes I know you say it's popular, Momo, but in political environments, you say something that can help to say this is going to change if we move this direction. Now, you didn't say a lot about the stimulus package. Some say it's not stimulus, it's just reprioritization of spending. But we know that the private sector has made declarations of their own investment. Perhaps you should have paid attention to giving us something that relates to what's going to happen in relation to economic growth to change the picture of the MTSF cycle going forward. I know you just focused on the MTPS and you do not want to look at policy shifts going forward, because announcements will be made come the budget announcement next year. But sometimes you leave a message, because by the time we go into the budget announcement and the policy shifts, and David Maynard and his cohorts will have made a lot of statements that are not going to be helpful. So it's on the basis of that I'm saying take this one into account. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mania.
Thank you, Chair. Let me begin by saying, I mean, the Honourable Tony... The Honourable Tony Tobias can't understand why the public sector wage bill has increased to the extent that it has. And it's quite simple. Government just simply caved into Kosatu, and that's why the public sector wage bill...
It's when you made people to be illiterate and unemployed during apartheid that has created this problem.
Order. You're going to debate that next week in the National Assembly.
It's rich being accused of not understanding economics from a person who believes the governor of the Reserve Bank raises inflation. Let me then...
No, as long as they don't want to accept that apartheid is a factor in the South African economy, it will remain the way it is. And he himself...
Please, Honourable Tobias, please.
Thank you, Chair.
His father is from Namibia.
I wonder if Treasury could tell us whether there's been a change of government policy on South African Airways. The Minister of Finance last night in New York said he believed that South African Airways should be shut down, which seems to me a remarkably fresh outlook on SAA. It seems government policy is quite different. It's defined on, I think, in your response to question 13, where government policy seems to be quite different. Government policy seems to be aimed at reconfiguring SOEs, which, as you say in your response, means in respect of SAA that you are considering creating a single aviation group and in bringing on board a strategic equity partner. The minister seems to have a very different view, and that is to shut down SAA. I wonder if Treasury could tell us whether there's been a change in government policy. Who's right? Are we shutting down SAA, or are we reconfiguring the airline? Thank you. Chair, then on a more serious note, I think the big, certainly positive aspect of the medium-term budget policy statement was the Minister's commitment to start to consider new fiscal anchors, and Ian, you talked about that. We certainly are in favour of a debt ceiling, and we are in the process of preparing a fiscal responsibility bill, which we intend to introduce before the end of this term. And the reason that it has been delayed is precisely because it is so hard to come up with a set of fiscal rules, I think, that will actually solve the problem. So I really look forward to that debate. In your response, I mean, you quote the Saxegaard paper and say that he regards 60% of GDP as a sort of debt ceiling. But the real question is, what is Treasury's view? At what point is our debt-to-GDP ratio, if you like, suboptimal? What is Treasury's view? I'm aware of the Saxegaard view. My question is, what is Treasury's view? So that's the first point on debt ceiling. Second point is a more a technical point. At what point does South Africa actually enter a debt trap, technically? The last point on the debt ceiling, then, is we say that a rule cannot solve the underlying problem, which, of course, as you correctly point out, is the composition of spending. But surely, Ian, that statement is untrue, because there are many countries that actually have designed fiscal rules on the expenditure side that do solve the composition of spending problem. For example, there are several countries, unless I'm mistaken, that have rules and prescribe ceilings on, for example, public sector wage expenditure as a proportion of revenue or as a proportion of expenditure. So, in fact, a fiscal rule can solve the composition of spending. So that's on the debt ceiling. I wonder if you could also comment, you've talked about general government debt, but I wonder if you could also comment on SOE debt. So that seems to me to be a significant problem, given the fact, obviously, that the stock of debt is significant. A significant proportion of SOE debt stock is guaranteed by general government. And if I'm not mistaken, a significant proportion of SOE debt is denominated in foreign currencies, I think up to 40%, as opposed to general government debt, which is about 10%. And then, of course, the new developing problem that we now, particularly where ESCOM is concerned, is a lack of transparency in respect of loans from Chinese banks. And I ask that because I think the aspect of the NCBPS book which really caused me to sort of sit up was the statement on page 48 in the fiscal risk statement, where you say that debt redemptions for the 10 SOEs will in fact exceed debt redemptions of general government over the medium term, which I think is a very sobering statistic. And I wonder whether, as we sort of debate the fiscal rules, whether we don't indeed need to consider a fiscal rule in respect of SOE debt. Then just on the VAT side, I think the submission that really struck me on the revenue side was the submission from PwC, which I think asked the pertinent question, which we still don't have an answer to. Was there a deliberate strategy on the part of SARS to withhold VAT payments in order to meet annual revenue targets. That really, I think, is something that we have to have an answer on, which I think is very, very important. Thank you, Jim.
Honourable Sir Blanche. No. You are always full of mischief. Honourable Sir Blanche.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me start by thanking Treasury for the presentation. Thank you very much. Chairperson, you know, obviously one agrees with the statement, you know, the opening statement, key points. Our main challenge is persistently low economic growth. My question is, Chairperson, and you know, the feeling that I'm getting that we want to hang this around the international trend of low economic growth. You know, but I think it is true, and I want to comment on that. You know, the impact of policy certainty here in our own beloved country, obviously it can contribute a lot to get our own people and other investors to invest and stimulate economic growth. And I want some response on that. I think that is something that, you know, I'm sensing that is deliberately, and maybe that's a strong word, you know, evaded. We don't want to touch on that. But I think that a lot can be done to, you know, get around this policy uncertainty. And yes, there are positive steps at the moment regarding that. But I want something on that. It is something that we can fix in our own backyard. That is just, you know, something that I want to say about that. Chairperson, then, secondly, obviously, you know, we are busy with fiscal consolidation. And budget cuts must be affected, you know, to bring about savings and obviously, you know, put the, you know, the stimulus package together and stuff like that. My concern is, Chairperson, that, you know, for instance, the police and others were mentioned as some of the departments where budget cuts, you know, have been affected, or, you know, obviously they are targeted then at least for that. We have a serious crime problem in this country already. We have a serious problem with education. We have a serious problem with health. And now, obviously it's going to impact there. What is the impact of that? Was that sort of calculated? You know, that is just something that concerns me also. Chairperson, then, it was also said that possible additional measures will have to be effected if necessary during the coming financial year. And my concern is, you know, just about all avenues is exhausted already. Where do you think will it be possible to affect that? Is it pay as you earn? VAT once again, or what other measures do you have in mind as a possibility at this moment? Chairperson, there's just something about the forecast. Yes, I accept the fact that it was said that Treasury is normally the best sort of, you know, predictors of the forecast. But I have a problem in that. I haven't said, you know, we've been sitting here year after year from one budget to the other, and every year it needs to be adjusted. So how good are we really? You know, the 0.07%, you know, obviously I think we can work on 50% of that, and that will give us a bigger, better picture of what the real, you know, picture is going to be. Chairperson, then something that really baffles my brain is this public sector wage increases. What is the mandate of this negotiators? How can you allow people to do that and come to some agreement and then we don't have the money to fund that. And then we shift that responsibility now to the departments, and you know, for instance, you know, provinces, local governments, wherever. If you go back to my argument about the police and other service delivery departments, they can only fund that, maybe, you know, by once again cutting on their intakes and training and, you know, first line sort of services that they need to render. How are we allowing this? Can't this negotiators be given, you know, some framework within, you know, where they can, you know, operate in? Really, I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense. Chairperson, and then lastly, you know, we have been visiting provinces quite often in our oversight responsibility as the NCOP. Chairperson, and I think we will agree that, you know, the projects that are executed, we don't get value for money. We have a problem with project planning. We have a problem with project management. And, you know, we end up having open-ended projects, just, you know, going on from the one financial year to the other financial year. And we really, that is a serious concern. Because, you know, the money that we have allocated, you know, was awarded to stimulate economic growth, and yet we don't get it. We are merely spending money. We are throwing money in this bottomless pit. And that is something that we can also address. And I just want to comment on that. Thank you, Chairperson. That is my input.
That's a remark from co-chair. Yeah. Honorable Monakedi. Order. Order.
Chairperson.
Honorable Monakedi.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Yeah. Indeed, on the issue of the wage bill, I think we need to get some further response on this one. As we indicated the other time, it was also flagged as one of the areas that need to be contained, but year in, year out, it looks like it persists with no real efforts to make sure that it is actually contained. President Cyril Ramaphosa yesterday spoke of the need for leadership in all these areas. So even on this one, my belief is that we need to make sure that we really give leadership and ensure that the matter is actually addressed. My understanding is that, as you have indicated, the problem is not the numbers. The problem is not necessarily the salary increase, no. The problem, as it has been alluded to, is the wastage, issues of unnecessary overtime, and all those. So I think really government should be able to work in together with the trade unions, ensure that this matter is actually dealt with in such a manner that it does not create the challenge that is now creating. The other area that I wanted to just comment on is under collection of taxes. I just want to check, what is the problem? Is it capacity, issues of stability, or what? Because I thought National Treasury, in terms of capacity, you are one of departments that are well endowed with whatever is necessary to make sure that you are able to collect the taxes that are due to government. And also on the issue of outsourced services, you are indicating here that outsourced services is actually one of the six items that are accounting for 50% of goods and services, especially as far as health and education are concerned. I just want to check as to whether have you considered insourcing this
items that you have alluded to, cleaning and security, so that you are able to then solve the matter once and for all. Because it looks like the biggest issue here is that these items are outsourced and they cost a lot to government. So are you considering making sure that they are insourced? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Let me also appreciate the responses that have been presented by National Treasury. I think you have tried to adequately respond to all that was raised by our stakeholders through submissions. There was a comment that says the stimulus package that has been presented by the President is actually not really supposed to be regarded as a stimulus package, but it's something like a reprioritization of projects. What would be your comment on that as Treasury? Let me also add my voice on saying I strongly believe that it's high time that we now impose the wealth tax. We need to consider imposing the wealth tax as a country. It will really assist us, you know, to maximize the GDP of our country. The last thing that I want to, I just want to remind the National Treasury that on Wednesday we received a delegation from our pensioners from Pietermaritzburg, and they were raising concerns around the amount of money that they are getting through pension payouts. And they were asking government whether it will be possible just to add a little bit for them, especially during the month of December, because they will be hosting grandchildren, you know, during holidays. Will it be possible for you maybe to comment on that?
Order, members. Are you done? Don't be interrupted. I'll protect you. Are you done? No.
In the process of learning how to fight David, because he really disrupted me.
Honourable members, coming to SARS, I posed a question last Thursday to the acting SARS commissioner about the rebuilding program of SARS. The announcement of late yesterday afternoon, early evening, is part of that. To get stability, you will have to appoint a SARS commissioner with a program of turning SARS around. And we got the steps, because I asked the acting commissioner, give me the steps, give the committee the steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, what are you going to do? And that was given to us. And the staff must, I hope they captured that, because it will guide us. I'm now going to give the stakeholders also. Yes, okay.
Firstly, I think, members, we hear you, Treasury, on the illicit economy, right? And we know it's very difficult, it's very elusive by its very nature. Tackling it, we understand that. And we don't know what the figures mean, but it's suggested by GFI that we lost $122 US billion dollars between 2002 and 2012. The figure that is bandied about, obviously it's very difficult by its nature to be precise, but it's $50 billion a year. Now, even if it's $5 billion a year, it's bad enough. So, we understand the difficulties SARS has gone through over the last few years, but we think, Momo and your team, that the minister should have said something. We can't prescribe that. Should have said something on the LSD economy. I mean, the tobacco industry is running riot over the last few years. Even if 1/100th of what is being said in books and articles in the paper is accurate, it's bad enough. And one of these people happens to be allegedly who's a kingpin, and this thing happens to be from my hometown. So it's a severe embarrassment to Imsen Dusi if that is true. We produced the Imsi Mans and the Koalas and the SP Marajas and so on and the Chota Motalas, and we can't have that. So please, if the person whose name keeps surfacing, I don't even say Momo, the criminal justice system lets you down. But look, on a serious note, can we agree that in our report researches, that we say that while we recognize the challenges, much, much more needs to be done. And we think, yes, it will take time, but we can do more. We are one of the 10 most vulnerable countries to the illicit economy. It would mean that we would be less inclined to introduce taxes that have a disproportionate effect on the poor, obviously meaning VAT. The second issue I'd like to ask is, Treasury, maybe you want to mull over this. How is it, notwithstanding the cleavage or whatever, the hiatus between the previous commissioner until yesterday, Tom Moyane, and Treasury, did you not know that such large amounts of money, which should have been returned in terms of VAT, was being withheld? Now, we heard rumors, right? And they were, Ms. Lees raised it with us first, but then as a chair, and I think others in our ANC members were also getting all these allegations made, including in the corridors of this parliament, from our own comrades who are not in the committee. But it's very hard for us as a committee. If people come and give you the statistics they do, how are we able, Paul Zakele and Antonio Manamela and Esther, how are they supposed to tell us, no, but these figures are not accurate? So the allegations. But it does raise things. I think we need to say something in our report. Parliament also needs to review what it does when people either wittingly or unwittingly misrepresent. Spinning is part of, even you as a senior manager spin, right? Spinning is like legitimate to some extent. But blatant misrepresentation or lying, Parliament can't accept that. So there has to be some action. I need to talk with Mr. Frolic and the Speaker's office about this. If it is true that there were deliberate misrepresentations made on such a major issue as revenue, some action has to be taken. Now, we need to look at that, and our report should raise that as something that we want to ask Treasury to give us a full explanation of why it is. Maybe it's understandable, Momo, that you couldn't tell us. You could have come and told us that, look, the commissioner is saying this and this, but it's not accurate. Nobody did that from Treasury either. We realized the torturous relationship at the time. Then, obviously, Tandy is right, the media, needless to say, contacted me, both about the SAA issue. Fortunately, it's public enterprises now. Until the ANC changes its position, we remain with the view we do. Tandy, we spelled it out. But they also asked me two SMSs, what is your view on Mr. Moyane? I thought, you know what, instead of it becoming like a chair just issuing a statement, where possible, because we are looking at the issue anyway, I think we should. Tandy, I spoke to Tandy a fleeting moment ago. We were not gossiping about what we're going to do over the weekend, which is obviously overseeing this report. I was asking her, what do you think we should do? So I think maybe, in fairness, it should go out from the committee. Would it be reasonable, having heard what the co-chair said now and others are hinting at, to say that we welcome the, although we would like to make our final views, although we'd like to express our final views on the Nugent Commission's work when the final report is issued, and the committee will consider it and presumably ask him here. We understand that his recommendation is a final one for the commissioner to go, and we feel that the president had no choice but to do what he has done in view of the numbers that are emerging about where SARS is, and in view of what's emerging, almost unanimously about what happened in SARS over the last 4 years or more, and the failure of the commissioner to present his side of the story, which is his choice, obviously. So I think we should say that we welcome it. Is that okay? Can we issue a short statement? Without going to sort of make much of it, but our own experience has been on the Makwakwa matter. Increasingly, it became very clear. On the Makwakwa matter, it was very clear. There's a lot of minutes of meetings that will come. On the Makwakwa matter, we were clear that something was fundamentally wrong in the way SARS dealt with that matter. And I also think you can't just say that you welcome the commissioner's dismissal. There were other people there, and one of them in particular, who was extremely aggressive, actually, and using all his intellectual skills to, like, you know, try to, what's the word, whitewash it. We have racial connotations. I don't know why people might say, you know, whitewash is like making white people, what, be presented as bad. So can we use whitewash in inverted commas? Because white people might protest that now they're being racially, derogated, if that's the word, right? So I don't know what the word is, but, you know, all I'm saying is, I think, is that fine? Is anybody have a problem with draft 3 lines or 4 lines, something along those lines? Okay. Then the next issue is, you know, we need to stress that the majority in this committee are not reckless or populist. We're excruciatingly aware of the need for revenue and how absolutely challenged the budget is, and what came last week through the MTBPS figures, I think, took us all by surprise. I gather from the media that even the experts who are always on our TV screens, the same group, and in the media, printed media, they didn't anticipate that the shortfall would be 27.4 billion. They were taken aback. They're even hinting, am I correct, that it'll be a small shortfall. Is that correct? So even the experts, whose lives revolve around these numbers, didn't foresee this, right? So I think the view of the committee has become a bit more sober since last week, or since that you know, we, as you know, it's expressed serious concern about the VAT increase. But, you know, now taking into account what happened last week, we also have to be a bit more strategic, and we will deal with that matter in our report, but also in the processing of the bills. But, Tandi, would it be right to draw attention to the following, right? Firstly, this debate between those economists who argue that VAT is not regressive and those who say it is regressive is something that I think should continue. But it's more for, in the current context, right now where we are, given where this country is, that's fine for the technical exchanges that experts can have in seminars and in university environments. The fact is, as you yourself say, National Treasury, it does lead to the increase in the cost of living. And it disproportionately affects the poor. And I think the people in Khayelitsha and Guguletu, as I said before, and Mitchell's Plain and Chatsworth, and the poor Afrikaners or poor white people, for them that's meaningless. When they go to buy basic commodities, they are paying more. So we are not academic experts or researchers. We are politicians responding to constituencies out there. So I think that debate can carry on in the seminar route. Our view, as I understand it, is that its effect on the poor is very unfortunate given the increase in fuel prices, job losses, and so on. Now here, SABC will be retrenching jobs, and indeed if SA is closed down, what happens to those people? We can have that debate in some other form. So we want to communicate that that debate can carry on, but for us it's neither here nor there in the current circumstances. Secondly, I think the case that Treasury makes that the zero-rated items are difficult to target, and actually, in effect, fat cats, including MPs here, on most of us, will benefit also, is a much better case now than it was before. But then this reinforces the case for more targeted expenditure, as your very own panel said. your very own panel said, have more targeted expenditure. So we welcome, as Tandy has already done repeatedly, a matter that was raised here 4 years ago, and Tracy's attitude, I said to the person concerned, was outrageous, really, and insensitive. We're glad you're doing what you're doing in terms of sanitary pads for learners. But we still hold the view that at some stage when our economy improves and our revenue numbers increase substantially, consideration needs to be given to making sanitary pads available freely. Even rich women should not be prejudiced by the fact that biology dictates what it does. And the main point we're making is we should never argue that because rich people will benefit, therefore we cannot give a concession to the poor. But that's a matter for the future. We're not saying now, Momo, before you get another heart attack. We're saying when the economy grows and additional revenue, the commissioner who really delivers, right? So please, don't have a heart attack, because I'm really worried about you, Momo. You feel it very much. Yeah. Sorry, not another. I said don't have a heart attack. Sorry. Secondly, the next thing I want to say is that, you see, I hear National Treasury saying, and I hear you, Momo, saying we should have, like, a review of all this pro-poor expenditure. It's not being managed very well. Tony makes the same point, right? We agree. But that's over a long term, right? Over the medium term. In the meanwhile, beyond sanitary pads, what we are asking you to consider is what else can you do in terms of targeted expenditure items to cushion specifically the 1% increase in VAT. What you seem to be saying as Treasury is, well, 60% of the MTEF period spending is for education, health, and all the social services and needs of the poor primary. That you would have done anyway. Whether it's not something that's emerging because of the specific increase of 1%. So you'd have done that anyway. It's almost disingenuous to say that. What we want to know is, what more can you do based specifically on the 1% VAT increase beyond what you would have done anyway in pro-poor expenditure? So that's what we're asking. Like you did with the female learners sanitary pads. That's what I said. In saying all of this, we suggest you look at the review panel, your own, and see what can be done. And come back to us fairly soon, and certainly before we vote on the tax bills, we would want to see what you're offering as possibilities. And we say this, again, to calm you down, Momo and your team, within the expenditure ceiling. When I say launch extra costs, reprioritize, that's right, Tani, we're saying reprioritize within the expenditure ceiling. And actually target specifically based and show us how it's based to the 1% VAT increase. Then on the SAA matter, quite frankly, I got asked by the media yesterday about that as well. All we want to say in regard to that, Tandy might want to add, Peggy might want to add, is that firstly, presumably, the Minister of Finance confers with the Minister of Public Enterprises. And David is right to draw attention to the inconsistencies. The official reply is on page 13, right? Yes. So the first thing we'd like to raise is presumably the Minister of Finance is talking to the Minister of Public Enterprises. Presumably government is looking at this issue. Presumably they're engaging with the trade unions. Presumably government's aware that job losses in SAPC and various private sector areas what happens to the employees of SAA. But it's for the Public Enterprises Committee to take this matter up with the Minister of Public Enterprises. So all we're saying is that until we hear from the Minister of Finance, our position is guided by the ANC position. We're accountable to the political party we come from. And so until now, our understanding was a strategic equity partner and a variety of partnerships with the private sector. When the minister came here, he raised it as a question. That's fine. But the new minister also has raised it. He said, do we need SAA? And so we said to him what our position is. And until I have a mandate from the party I come from, or this committee, that's our view. We may be wrong, but we need to engage. So what I'm saying is that for us, until now the minister was saying, let's look at this, let's review. That seemed to us reasonable. But now there's a final decision. I don't know if it's final or how the decision is taken. But presumably the Public Enterprises Committee needs to be briefed. The Public Enterprise Committee is briefed, and if necessary, we should go to that meeting. Thank you. Oh, before I finish, comrade, I just need to make two announcements, if you can give me a few minutes. Then. The program has to change because we have an extra week of parliament now. Secondly, I think we should welcome back Linda Enfotandi. Now, she left on a holiday again without consulting our committee, not offering to take us with her. She disappeared without writing a letter to us and telling us she's gone. She's the most active member of this committee, even more than you, Dandi, and me, and Charles. And therefore, we were shocked that you just disappeared. But welcome back. And can you table a report on your holiday when you get some time? Because we now have an extra week in Parliament, and that Tuesday of the extra week, we will ask for a two-hour report. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Yes, that's right. There's a difficulty now about Tuesday. Apparently, there's 11 o'clock special caucuses or something. So, yes, she's right. So, So can we rather meet colleagues? No, she's right. Can we rather meet from 9:30 to 11 to process our MTBPS report? And the debate is on. Yeah, okay. Let's no. Okay, let's discuss that. Okay. Yeah, the debate is on Wednesday. Okay, so we have to finish the report on Tuesday. Thank you very much. We'll meet at 9:30 for now.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Kusato. After Kusato, Ota, if you want to come in here, and then PBO. Order.
Okay, thanks very much, Comrade Chair. Chair, I think maybe just three quick things from our side. I think we would have welcomed the President's finally dismissing the SARS Commissioner as the most fantastic news. I think it wouldn't be exaggerated to say that he has been one of the two people who really placed us in this crisis in the state. I think, Chair, we'd also agree with Comrade Chair Karim that the sobriety of the crisis has really forced us to look at issues hard. I think, Chair, the first point is that we were disappointed with the MTBPS because we didn't get a sense of a clear turnaround plan, whether it's in terms of stabilizing the debt levels, because we've been seeing the trajectory going up each year. And we're very worried. In fact, we're more pessimistic than Comrade Tito that we're heading straight towards the IMF. We think, Chair, that given the severity of the crisis, we should actually look at reviving the old ESCOM war model approach in terms of stabilizing the state, turning the economy around, where you have government, industry, labor, civil society. We want really to see a clear plan to move the economy forward. How are we going to recover that stolen money and see people thrown in prison? Chair, I think we were disappointed that the MTBPS didn't really flesh out government stimulus plan or the job summit or investment summit plans, which I think would go a long way towards turning around the economy. Chair, in terms of SARS, if there's one thing we could plead with for SARS is the issue of both the tobacco and also the clothing industry illicit flows. We've seen clothing illicit customs enforcement plunging from about R1 billion a year to about a few million rand. And of course, it also decimates the economy as well, the industry. I think Chair would really want to see a clear turnaround plan for the SOEs, especially ESCOM, which is really our epicenter of the potential state collapse. Second issue, Chair, around the VAT, I think we do appreciate the VAT concessions. We actually were doubtful that we would get a single VAT concession. So we do appreciate those three concessions. But again, we're not sure, given the amount of economic crisis facing workers across the board, that the two flour items and sandwich pads are sufficient. So we really want to appeal to the government and the parliament to consider some mix of additional concession, whether it's around school uniform vouchers for locally produced uniforms, or it's around increasing the free water and electricity allocation or reducing the tariffs. But some additional measure to help people who are being battered by the economy, by tax hikes, etc., etc. And the last issue, Comrade Chair, look, I think we want to plead to Honourable Mania that as Kosato we plead guilty for fighting for a living wage for our nurses, our teachers, our police officers who put their lives at risk. I think Dennis George showed a nice graph around the wage gap in the public sector, which is worse than we at the SOEs. So a nurse can make 200,000 rand, but an IT manager at SARS makes 3 million rand. You ask who really produces actual value for money. I think it's the nurses, Chair. But I think, Chair, look, we want to plead not guilty for building in Kandla. And I think we really need to acknowledge the extent how corruption is putting us into this crisis, how wasteful expenditure is hampering us. But look, Chair, we are willing to engage with government at the PSCBC. We've got proposals from our side how to save costs, how to improve service delivery across the board. I think, Chair, we also need a balance of perspective that the wage bill is 35% of the budget, not 80%. The headcount has been reduced by 3% in the past 2 years, and there is a huge wage gap. Chair, I think we must also acknowledge the extent that the crisis of freezing posts has put in education, where classroom teacher ratios are increasing to 40 per class in some areas, and also that there is currently about 148,000 funded public service vacancies. So that's 10% of public service wage bill right now. Having said that, Chair, we're looking forward to government consolidating departments next year. We think a cabinet of 25 is sufficient. But we're shocked that in last week's papers that there was an advert for the Department of Rural Development for a DG. And for us, that was one of the posts which must, departments which must be integrated with agriculture. So why are we advertising a DG post when I think we've got elections in May or April next year, 6 months away? So I think that's part of the problem, that government doesn't speak to government. I think, Chair, also we want to plead with government that the President signed a very progressive commitment not to retrench public service, public sector workers. Yet we've got SABC wanting to retrench a third of its permanent staff and half of its freelancing staff. Yet the Minister of Communication yesterday disclosed very interestingly to NCOP that 10 managers at SABC earn 24 million rand a year. And we see no effort to slash those wages. You could have cut those wages by three quarters if government or SABC was willing to be engaging. I think Chair must also acknowledge that some workers have not taken increases previously. Post office workers 2 years ago sacrificed an increase. SA Express has not received their increase for the staff members. I think Chair would really been raising this for years. I think now is the time. I think Momo might agree with us now. Of having one single wage negotiation process for the entire state, be it departments, be it local governments, be it the SOEs. That's partly why we signed a 3-year wage agreement to provide some financial stability or budgetary stability for the state for planning forward. But you can really see the huge wage gaps in the SOE level or in other entities. Chair, the last two issues quickly. We think there's a crisis in local government that the government is not paying attention to. You would have seen yesterday that in West Rand municipality, workers have not been paid. And there's about a dozen other municipalities where workers will not be paid because of the VVS scandal. And simply those municipalities must be put under administration. And then lastly, Chair, I think we'd want to see bold leadership from government, and we can give a blank check to Momo on this, to slash executive perks and pay. It's really difficult to kick nurses, yet you have ministers having the right in the handbook to fly their wives overseas, Chair. So that's it in a nutshell, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Kusatu. Ota? Ota?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity to actually participate here. Just to give an overall question, the heading of this response from National Treasury is response to questions posed. And I don't think that the shareholders really posed questions to National Treasury during the hearings. We're doing that now. But I would just like to understand, because we really believe that participation is very important for the budgeting process and for policy making in general. So does National Treasury really take into account the recommendations that were made, as opposed to only coming here to answer questions? Many of these rows actually start with the phrase, what is all? It's just an exercise of clarification. I would just like to understand, does it take the recommendations made by stakeholders seriously? So on a few particular points with regards to targeted expenditure, we agree this is extremely important. And one of the only solid things that I've gotten from the presentation is that there should be some sort of a system or exercise to ensure that targeted expenditure is actually impactful and that that can be measured and monitored. And we completely agree with that. In China, for example, Chairperson, you asked for examples from other countries. There, quantitative performance indicators are actually put in place, and if accounting officers of certain municipalities don't achieve those targets, then they get replaced. Would we consider something like that in South Africa? It might be effective. With regards to corruption, the question is answered, what is National Treasury doing about political influence on tenders? And the answer is, it's simply a statement of what does the law say. In terms of the MFMA, politicians are prohibited from participating in procurement processes. That's not really an answer. What is National Treasury doing is a different question, as opposed to how does it actually work and whether politicians are allowed to participate. Then, Chairperson, on SAA, for example, we agree that it's a problem that there's contradictory statements. The question is answered, what is meant by reconfiguration? We would like to hear whether the National Treasury actually agrees with the sentiment that's been conveyed by stakeholders that SOEs like this that are extremely insolvent should actually be privatized, either partially or completely. What is their opinion on this? And then on Sunroll and why they received 5.9 billion rand. I think once again, Chairperson, that this is a question that wasn't really asked. The question was posed to stakeholders yesterday or the day before. Should this happen, as opposed to why? Why is this happening? And we said no. And I think that the easy answer to the question why Sunroll received this money or why are they suggested to receive it is because they need it. I think a better question is why do they need it? And is this really the solution to that problem? Then, Chairperson, just on the strategy that's been taken to address issues in SOCs, because we all know that it's a very significant risk for the economy. National Treasury refers to the Shareholder Management Bill, and it states what the ministers should actually ensure when entities are under their watch, and they give a list of 7 points, and they're all good points. We would just like to understand, does National Treasury really believe that this is the best solution and that this will avoid undue political influence in the business of SOCs? Is this the optimal way to do things? Thanks, Chairperson. That's all.
Thank you, Dr. Yankees.
Thank you, co-chairs. Good morning, honourable members. I think what we did, Chair, yesterday, we sent a summary of our input to the research for the report, so I think we'll not comment much on the further. I think what we will do, we would give inputs on the two pages that was requested to look at specific mechanisms that can be used to ease the burden on the low household income. From the discussion last week, I'm trying to unlock my computer here. But I think what we did, we looked at the household survey that looks at household consumption, which was also used by the independent panel appointed by the ministry there, to look at which of these household consumptions could be used to try to ease the pressure on the low-income households. But I think also there are three main groups of expenditure which account for more than 70% of the low-income households: food and non-beverage, household electricity, water, and fuel, and transport. I think what we try to do, co-chairs, we focus on the transfers, to say what are the expenditure program which could be used, you know, over the short term, medium term, and also over the long term. I think what we did actually realize the discussion in the literature about the impact of social programs is far much better than using the zero-rated, quite strong argument as the colleagues from Treasury have just noted, that target expenditure are more effective in reducing the burden compared to zero-rated sound supplies. But of course, I mean, the South African government already have quite a variety of social spending programs which are targeted to low-income households, and I think In our discussions and acquisition, the office was probably one of the ways could be to how to expand the current program as they are to try to reach wider low-income households, because the issues try to see how can they, in the short term, use the current measures to cover those are not covered, those income low-income households which are not covered currently, even though it might not be enough to alleviate the pressure from the low-income households, but could go quite a long way to cover those uncovered poor households. I think the big point that we also noted is the current social spending program doesn't cover this particular group in society who are classified within the low-income households who are not covered in the current social programs. When you get unemployed, age between 18 and 59 are not covered quite by any social programs that we have currently. And those are some of the households that are badly affected by, the increase in tax and VAT or the fuel and so on. So we looked at three programs. We looked at a social program that is currently in place. Again, we look at three items. I mean, these are the items already within the current government spending programs, but it's to see how we could tweak them up to try to be more broad-based. The first item, we look at social grant system to say already government has that mechanism in place, and over half of households in all households are covered somehow, are benefiting from these social grants. The old age and child support grant is quite targeted. About 80% of a poor household benefits from the old age grant and social and child support grant. And of course, if you listen to the pensioners from Peter Maritzburg on Tuesday, on Wednesday, they even said it goes beyond them. They even use it for unemployed citizens as well who are not covered by other measures. The expert panel had estimated that an annual increase of 240 of the child support grants may offset the impact of VAT increase on the four lowest deciles in households. However, I mean, as I said earlier, the issue is that the current system doesn't cover unemployed age between 18 and 59, which would mean that there could be have to be created mechanisms to try to cover them as well within the system, those who are not covered, because currently focus on all age children, and they are unemployed between 18 and 59 who are classified under poor or low income households. So there would need to be consideration how do you bring them up in the system to be covered or to be protected from higher cost of living as a result of many aspects. And like I say, we're not saying this will be sufficient, but at least we'll provide some base for these low-income households. The second aspect, but again, it's worth mentioning that it's not sufficient. As the panel expert often says, it's not going to be sufficient, but we need to provide such mechanisms. The second point, it's support for food and nutrition is, again, it's within the government expenditure system, program. And again, food and non-alcoholic beverages is the highest consumer item by low-income households. Of course, the current nutrition program, food program, it supports the children and currently have, I think, over 9 million learners are provided for, a meal a day. And so on. And I think when we look at, in our discussion, and also look at how things are done in other countries, we thought maybe you might need to expand it beyond school to cover widely, the low-income households who are not benefiting, who are not getting food, because the food is a big thing. Or even go beyond one meal, make it quite, maybe two meals, so that when the kids go home, they had two meals in the day. And again, I'm using the discussion from the pensioners in Pinnabalus Bay as an example to say, you know, the kids are not very happy with the level of food and so on. But we also looked at how other countries are helping the low-income households with providing food. And there was an example that we picked up where in other countries they have food banks where low-income households somehow go to these food banks in different areas where they collect basic food items which they could consume and cook at home, but on a 6-year interval. But of course, it means government have to provide for these food banks. Government provides for those food banks in those other countries. That's another example, which of course could be also be useful to make sure that the food program is quite wide, supports those who are missing within the whole social system. The last point is public transport, one of the third highest expenditure for low-income households as well. And again, government provides subsidy for public transport, but you realize that actually particularly buses and trains, there's a government program for subsidy somehow in those main transport systems. But the study that shows that due to unreliability of the public transport, or even for other reasons, trains and buses, a majority of the low-income households will prefer to use taxis as a mechanism of transport to either go to work and back from work, but also even going to buy food and so on. And the difficulty is that there isn't a direct support to taxis. As a result, they are not benefiting in the support that's currently in place. And there could be an idea to be creative on how would you make sure that in the short term you support low-income households by either providing a relief to taxes or whatever mechanism that could be in place, because that's where majority of the low-income households majority of households transport they're using. And of course, we also thought about the costing as well over the short term, that it could be, as the chair was saying, reprioritizing the current expenses or access programs. Okay, chair, I'm continuing. But also the panel had also suggested, the panel of experts suggested UIF as one of the way that the low-income households who are currently contributing to it could also access it to try and alleviate some of the pressures that they have. But of course, there are challenges and so on. Because it's not meant for that, it's meant for specific purposes and so on. But I think in a conclusion, of course, since these are the measures that are already in place, any intervention, only thinking around, would have to take into account the current pros and cons. What are the challenges that are facing these three programs, and how to deal with that at the same time? Of course, in the short term, over the medium term and long term, but also there would also need to be consideration of the implications for Money Bills Act in if that measures are taken forward. Thank you.
Did you work now from a paper in addition to your paper on Tuesday? Can you circulate that to members?
It was circulated yesterday.
Thank you. Right. That's it. Sorry.
Some study raises this thing about pensioners, and you do as well, Tumisani. Just see what message we got from the coordinator. So thank you very much for accommodating us today. We are enormously grateful that we were allowed all the space we needed to talk directly to the committee. Thank you also for your kindness in organizing lunch and a tour of Parliament. We hadn't realized how exhausted we were, and so did not take up the tour. Thank you so much. And thank you also to, she says Zolani, but I think she means Tebogo, who ran madly around with us. Or was it Zolani? Zolani, did you do it? I thought it was Tebogo, sorry, because I had asked her to do it. Okay, I'm giving the wrong person credit here. Okay, Zolani, thanks. The pensioner struggle will be a long one, and we hope to be back again should we feel that it will be useful. Thanks again for the dignity in which you provided all who came before you. Sincere regards to the Pensioners Fund, Peter Miller's Pensioners Forum. So the thing is that I have spoken with Alan and Tebogo that in future or on your side, Solani and whoever, if such a thing happens, we must make the necessary arrangements. They came by bus. They rolled in at about 11. I didn't know who they were. I thought they were coming to observe the house. The committee, you know, some have become... Secondly, to be fair to the committee secretaries, I do not want to deal with issues I had with the Speaker's office and directors, but the committee secretaries were not aware. When somebody says pensioners forum and give us a translator, they didn't know what it actually meant. That'll be, you know, old gogos in their 60s and 70s. And for them to come by bus and for us to say, speak for 10 minutes, and then, you know, goodbye, is really like inhumane. So no one's going to blame the committee secretaries because that issue is getting raised. We just think we managed it very badly. Nobody's to blame, but you know we did get at least an acknowledgement. Thank you. Can I just suggest one thing, Chairperson? You know, we've got very limited time and we have to take decisions because the report has to be done over the weekend. So on the matter of targeted expenditure, we should ask our committee secretaries to take what the PBO has said and put it in simple, straightforward proposals for the committee to the extent the researchers think they agree with it, and we will look at it ourselves as the chairs and so on. So that the thing we mustn't do is be disingenuous. You know, like say, well, like for example, social grants are going to increase anyway. They usually do. So to say, we regret that the VAT increase has come about. And you know what? We are cushioning the effects of it by giving you the increase that we would have given you anyway. We have to show in what way the increase in social grants to Asani, Zakele, Antonia, Neste is going to be different, or we're proposing it be considered different. Or what is it because of the VAT increase, which we would not have done otherwise as a government, right? Or the government would not have done. Is now being done to take into account the 1% increase. Otherwise, every year the grants increase. That's what I'm trying to say. We mustn't lie to ourselves. And the Kosatu is not going to buy it. The NGOs are not going to buy it. They're going to say, you increase the grant every year. So what's the big deal? So we have to look for targeted expenditure that's related to the VAT increase. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Also this morning on RSC, there was a report about the delegation from Pietermaritzburg coming to do their presentation in terms of public participation. So I just want to convey that. Honourable members, a public audit amendment bill is due to be signed by the President. I did a follow-up this morning. Where is this bill lying now? It's on the table of the President. This bill will allow the Auditor General to be more decisive, zooming into irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. Now, we're waiting for that, because this is going to assist Parliament, referring to a problem that the Ad Hoc Committee on the Intervention in Northwest is dealing with now. And things are happening there to do things better. And we must be more decisive in our oversight. Much more decisive. Also, that we on a quarterly basis as joint committees call National Treasury and SARS to monitor the economic growth in that period. The PBO brings out a quarterly economic review, but we look at that. And then, lastly, I mentioned on losses that to look at different models in aviation. And I mentioned Malaysian Airlines, and I mentioned KLM in France, I mentioned Alitalia. There are different models to look at. What did they do to turn themselves around? And they tried. So Swiss Air was another scenario. Another scenario by the Minister of Finance. Politicians in tender processes is part of her work to expose it. While we, precisely what we're doing in Northwest at this moment in terms of the intervention. Thank you, Treasury.
Thank you, Chair. We've got many questions. We're going to just break them up into themes rather than answer each individual one. I think, Chair, and I think just to make an obvious point, perhaps to some of us who come here every year or are at it all the time, I know that many of the comments made, people may not have participated in previous processes. Just to remind ourselves, the MTPPS deals with the macro and fiscal framework for the budget that will be there next year, right? And obviously adjust for the current year, the growth forecast and so on. It deals with the big numbers of what we think the level of expenditure will be, the revenue deficit, and it deals with what each sphere or each province and the total local government share. Of course, what it doesn't do is to get down to specific expenditure proposals. It does it a bit for the adjustments this year, but it doesn't really allocate expenditure for next year. We do it in broad functional terms to indicate the direction that we... Sorry? And yeah, and by sphere of government also. So that's what we do. So similarly, we don't deal with specific tax proposals. So that's why I think it's a bit difficult, even where we are looking at, say, targeted expenditure. Obviously, what we want to do is take proposals here and take it for the budget announcements to be made in February. That's where it would be given effect. If we can explain it. No, I think the members here understand. I'm not explaining to the members. I think just some of the comments that we've received. Also, I think there's been comments on specific tax proposals. As Chris has said, a lot of those will be taken as input for the budget. So I just wanted to clarify that. So what we're going to do now is maybe let's just start with the specific issues that are there. Now, obviously, and I want to say even before we get to questions that we've been asked, the minister has raised lots of comments, okay? And I think he's a refreshing input and he's asking hard questions. These are not announcements of government. I've read the FT article, which I know Honourable Mainier also reads regularly. All the papers today, the questions you ask about SAA is based on an interview that is done with the Financial Times. Okay, so if you read the original, I don't think he's saying anything different from what he's saying. He's saying there's no holy cows. He's saying we need to look at these issues. Maybe he's expressing it in a stronger way, but I think he's raised this issue. I mean, just for members, we've also been to NEDLAC last week, and where the minister raised this in a very forthright manner with all the stakeholders there, okay? And he contextualized just the way he was posing these questions. So I think we're not going to answer specifically. The minister is currently, was in New York with investors. I think now he's flying back somewhere, so I'm just answering just generally, I think, just to contextualize, I think, the comments. And I think certainly as Treasury, we think there are no holy cows. We agree strongly with the minister, and these questions have to be posed, because ultimately the budget is about trade-offs. And the hard choices have to be made, that if you want higher growth, we're going to have to cut down on recurrent expenditure. And most of the recurrent is in remuneration. So how do you actually deal with those sorts of issues?
Okay, thank you.
Chair?
Just on a point of order,
the Member
didn't answer my question. My question wasn't whether the minister was saying something different to what the minister was saying. My question was whether the minister was saying something different to what government was saying, or should we just attribute this to what I believe is known as open mouth operations on the behalf of the minister?
We will have to start thinking differently, out of the box. We can't carry on as in the past. It's interesting, it's honky dory. Get it? It's not going to work.
And I think, Chair, if you look at those questions, they're very important signals, okay? Every time you bail out an SOE, every other municipality or provincial government wants to be bailed out. I mean, it's obviously a well-known phenomenon of moral hazard. And taking what you say, Chair, I think the Minister made two important comments which we'd like to expand on. The one is you've got to get a culture of compliance with the PFMA and MFMA. There's a lot of entities today that people think they overspend and there's no consequences. And even before you get to fruitless and irregular expenditure, and I do think, having done the PFMA, irregular expenditure is a very big category. You don't know what's, as you know, what's corruption, what's technical non-compliance. It's a big basket. But two categories are very clear. Fruitless and wasteful is clear. Okay. If you take unauthorized expenditure, it's even clearer. It is that this was your budget and you exceeded it. And that can never be just allowed. Some of it we don't allow just through the systems. You're simply not allowed to make those payments. But as you get to SOEs and municipalities who are not part of the national system, you can't lock it down on the system. But I guess we want to get, so firstly, a strong culture of compliance to PFMA and MFMA. And let me say, and you know, many of us will certainly make submissions in other forums, that as the Treasury has been undermined, attacked, many people felt they could, not they felt, they did get away with not following the PFMA and MFMA, and there were no consequences. Even when they were referred to the prosecuting authorities, nothing happened, okay? So let's just not forget that. I think the second point, and I think it's an important point, which is to get the culture of payment right in our country. And this is not just people not paying for their electricity or water, that's part of it. It's also about municipalities not paying over to ESCOM. And if we have a situation where payments are not made, then I think that we are entering into dangerous territory where people who should be paying don't pay, impact on service delivery. And I will come back to the question, say, posed, for example, by AUTA. I think it's unfortunate, this call of almost don't pay for tolls and so on. The impact of that, I think, has been huge in terms of tax morality. And similarly, I think, just as government needs to be accountable for its action, the approach taken, somehow, by all intents and purposes, I haven't seen any strong indications of corruption, etc. You can argue with judgment calls that were made, but the fact that, you know, there's an advocacy of non-payment there has consequences for other services, both in terms of future roads and as consequences for other services where payments require. So in a way, I think we need to take care that if you want to build a strong state, I think it's important that some of these issues are taken up differently and we are careful not to undermine the culture of payment. But I will come to those issues. And I think those are two themes that the Minister again focused on, because that's the reality. You want to start with just the macro and so on.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
I'm going to argue here.
No, no, no. Let them reply, honourable members.
Okay.
That's what you requested.
Thank you, Chair. So there were quite a few questions on what has driven the wage bill over time. There are really two elements to it. The one is the cost of living adjustments, but the other element are automatic cost pressures in the system, so automatic notch increases, for example, over time. And we estimate that, you know, even if you have a cost of living adjustment in line with CPI inflation, those automatic cost pressures add another 1.5% or so, between 1 and 2% cost pressure in the system. So you always have real growth in wages, of the overall compensation bill as a result. So the point we were trying to make again, that headcount hasn't been the major driver. It's largely to do with these automatic cost pressures. And that those have been exacerbated by the occupation-specific dispensations. Again, you know, not taking a view on whether it was the correct decision or not, we're simply stating that the OSDs did two things. One, they raised the average income of certain categories of workers substantially, and they have faster automatic notch increases included in the OSDs. And so one conversation I think we should be having is whether or not the rate of increase should not be standardized again over the public service. Quite a few questions on the stimulus and, you know, what is in there, what isn't. I mean, again, as we said before, we are in a tight fiscal situation, and we're trying to find a balance between stabilizing debt and not closing the deficit too rapidly in a way that could harm service delivery and growth. So if you look at the current year, the first choice was to allow the revenue shortfalls to feed through, first of all, to higher debt, which has an automatic stabilizer effect on the economy. And, of course, there's going to be a 20 billion, relative to the initial estimate, 20 billion more in VAT refunds in the current year. We think both of those are supportive of the economy in the short term. But, of course, we didn't have fiscal space for significant changes in the current year. So I think that the most important element of this stimulus and recovery plan as announced by the President is the idea of putting DFI and private sector and government investment front and center, the idea of an infrastructure fund which opens up opportunities for the DFIs and the private sector to bring in credit, but more importantly to bring in oversight, governance, and of course technical capacity in designing and running infrastructure projects. We think that's a very positive signal. And to add to that, what we've been saying for a while as Treasury, the issue in infrastructure is not funding. There's about 484 billion rand in the general government infrastructure pipeline over the next 3 years. Our experience with the budget facility for infrastructure is precisely that preparedness of the projects that are coming to the budget process that is the issue and not the funding thereof. So a lot of effort, and that's why some of the funding that we've proposed goes towards the Government Technical Assistance Center, to the Development Bank of Southern Africa, and to the President's, to the PICC, in order to improve the quality of the infrastructure projects before they come into the budget process. And I also think that's a very positive step forward. Okay, there were a lot of general comments on growth and the outlook. Questions on the fiscal anchors. This is a very, as Honourable Menir mentioned, it's a very complicated thing, having a fiscal responsibility law bill. And again, we as Treasury are certainly open to these discussions, but I think a fair reading of the literature would say that it's almost impossible to pinpoint a level of debt, and we agree with that. So there is not an optimal level in our view. Okay. So, you know, I think that the paper that I've spoken about a few times by Saxegaard is very good because it tries to measure probable future revenues and expenditure trends and says, is it broadly sustainable or not? And the view that in broad terms, if you reach 60%, it's going to be very hard to come back. If you're going to go beyond 60, it's going to be very hard to bring down debt after that. And that you should probably have a buffer of around 20 percentage points of GDP in case you have another global financial crisis. I think that makes a lot of sense. So I wouldn't say we're in a debt trap yet, but we are. You know, if you're going to start implementing fiscal decisions that basically reduce the denominator faster than you can close the primary deficit, then you're going to start getting into this. And it's not a science. It's really not. But especially the literature on fiscal multipliers, which is all over the place, and there's not much agreement on that. But a very interesting area of the research that's come out recently has said the impact of fiscal consolidation in a recessionary environment is much worse than we had thought. And that is precisely one of the reasons why we've allowed some slippage in year, because we're in a recessionary environment. We don't want to be cutting spending and raising taxes further. But we are open to discussions on this, and we want to make it clear this is complex and it isn't very straightforward. Yes, you could have a rule to protect the composition of spending. There are countries that have introduced golden rule, they call it. You split your current and your capital spending, and you say, well, you can't, current must grow at a certain rate, and you're not allowed to touch your capital budgets. And there's something in that. I think we can look into it. But again, to say it's not a panacea, because if you haven't dealt with the pressures in current spending, I think maybe a rule can assist, but it's not going to deal with the underlying pressure. And secondly, there has been examples in some countries where they start then reclassifying current spending as capital and so on. So everything has trade-offs and costs and benefits, and I think we should definitely look into this, but it's not going to solve the underlying pressures on the budget necessarily. It could help. Okay, then some of the questions on what could be done on the spending side, and I'll just point to two things. The first is, as I mentioned, I think we should be looking again at the spending, the transfers going to public entities, and I hear also the comments from Kasatu about the wage bill in public entities. I think that is definitely an area where we should be reviewing and looking again at the large wage bill of public entities. And then to say again that across-the-board cuts are going to become more and more difficult, and we really need to start looking at the policy choices that we're making. So a short while ago, earlier this year or last year, we published a series of expenditure reviews. One of those expenditure reviews, as an example, found that the current housing policy was effectively not affordable in the existing fiscal envelope. So it seems clear that a decision there has to be taken ultimately about what is the future of housing policy in the country, rather than saying we're going to do across-the-board cuts on budgets. And, you know, we've made some hints towards that also in the MTBPS by saying we're trying to centralize housing subsidies so that we can leverage more of the private sector in providing subsidies to middle and low-income households. But it seems to me, you know, that's an area of reform that and decisions will be required, rather than saying we continue with the existing policy framework. I've covered quite a lot of ground. Maybe just a final comment. You know, the Auditor General and the OCPO are very much involved in financial management and looking particularly at reviewing contracts and reviewing procurement processes and where required, informing departments that they'll have to restart their procurement processes. So, I mean, I can't speak exactly on their behalf, but they are heavily involved in managing the procurement processes in national and provincial government. Just to mention one last thing before I hand over. Yes, there was some reprioritization of funds. That 5.75 in SANRAL was from non-toll capital to current to basically cover debt repayments. And as Momo has already mentioned, again, policy decision, if a decision isn't taken there, then SANRAL has uncertainty and SANRAL can't access the capital markets and their build and maintenance program slows down, which is what we've seen. We think SANRAL has a lot of capacity to manage and implement infrastructure projects, and so we proposed as part of the reprioritization that they receive a transfer from FASA to SANRAL for a capital to capital transfer. And yes, you know, we're in a very tight budget, but we're looking for places where we think the quality and rate of infrastructure spend will improve. Thank you.
Debra, you don't have anything to add? Sure, you've been very quiet. Just, you know, you have to say something, Debra. Okay. Okay, let me answer just some of the, Chris and I will answer
Let him first reply, and then you can come in to any other members. We must be mindful of your time, members. We'll have to adjourn at 12. There's other meetings that some of us must attend. Thank you.
I think just on the issue of, let me start with revenue collection and why that didn't happen. Obviously, Treasury doesn't collect revenue, it's SARS. And it gets to the heart of the issues at SARS, and I think the co-chair has also raised some strong issues. Chair, I would say that it is really worth reading the Nugent interim report. You know, interim is not provisional. The judge has made clear it's final. It's just that there's still going to be other reports. And the recommendation that has been made is a final recommendation. And it is a very disturbing report. What the commission has found, so as reported, is whether it's the IT systems, whether it's the tobacco story, you know, the organization was systematically being destroyed and taken backwards. And hence the recommendation was, you know, clear that you've got to fire the current commissioner, current up to yesterday, and that the other recommendation is the president should move with speed to appoint a new commissioner because they say that's a necessary condition. It's not a panacea by itself, but you need a new commissioner. And I think it makes some reference towards the process to appoint should be open, transparent, and credible, something like that, words to those effect. So that's the sum total of the recommendation that's made. So I think on a lot of issues like we've been asked on VAT refunds and so on, you know, it's certainly we as Treasury, we simply don't know. Okay, yes, we saw the tax ombuds report with specific, we heard all the complaints, but unless you went into specific taxpayer files and you knew that they were due for their refund, and I think how the commissioners explained, also more cases were sent for audit than, you know, is the case and so on. So those things, only Judge Nugent, I would expect, or the commission can actually look at those files. That's why the president obviously referred that matter to the commission. So I think, and you know, Judge Nugent, everything that I've seen, is the commission is working very efficiently, and I think they have to report by the end of November on their final report. So hopefully we will get some answers there, and I think certainly the committee can take up the issues because I think they will get into the detail of what happened on tobacco, on VAT refunds and so on. As far as from a macro perspective, I think what we saw, and it was certainly a surprise to the Treasury until a few weeks before MTBPS as we were preparing, it's almost like this practice became baked into the system at SARS, okay? And certainly required, I think, a lot of interrogation of the numbers, a look at the credit book and what was happening there to understand that whatever the problem is, and we're still obviously analyzing, but the point was this. We saw that there were refunds, they're due, and we were clear that it should be released immediately. It should never have been held back because we all understand the impact on businesses and so on. And I think that the MTBPS, that was a shock, and that's why even for the market, didn't realize how big the credit book is and that it was increasing even in India, okay, because those had become established practices. For the acting commissioner, and as we engage, when they saw what was happening, certainly for the MTBPS, that was reversed. Chris can go into the specific numbers. He's done it earlier on, you know, what the level was of 11 billion was due to refunds that should have been paid out as soon as possible, and 9 billion was also, with a higher VAT rate, the refund rate also goes up, and there was certainly our projections were wrong. So those were the things that even analysts weren't seeing. And remember, the analysts also don't see the September numbers. because that normally is done 30 days after. So it's after MTBPS. So we could see a slowdown already. So I think those were the reasons why, there's no doubt, the market was shocked about the VAT numbers and where we are on collecting of revenue. I think just in terms of some of the other questions related, because it does get to the customs modernization, I would still say that it's important, I think, for this committee also to call SARS on customs modernization, because much of it, as there are illicit flow issues with regard to transfer pricing, I think customs and the tobacco story and other issues are also big issues. And in fact, some of the illicit flows, if we saw, seems to have been simply that people put them on an aeroplane when they fly to Dubai and they were taking funds like that, aside from electronic transfers. So one needs to obviously look at the source and see, did our agencies do everything in their power to stop that? I mean, I don't want to get into the issues of what the number is. I think that's not important and will never be right, just given the nature of it being illicit. The point is, every agency should be doing everything at all stages to take steps that they should be taking. But I would really say that it would be worth going into the customs modernization issue and getting back to the issue of the border management agency, because I think that will be a real problem if customs is fragmented. Yes, SARS should have been doing it better and moved backwards, but I think giving it to another agency is not going to solve the problem. It could actually make the problem worse. So I think that that's something that needs to be watched. The bill is, as you know, in front of the NCOP, and it shouldn't introduce more uncertainty for SARS on that score. I think with regard to the other issues like the wealth tax and so on, the Davis, again, just to make the point earlier, those will be proposals we'll look at for the budget, but the Davis Tax Committee did produce a report last year on firstly, some of the challenges that we face, because it's one thing to do it on income. It's income is something we measure. We haven't really systematically started collecting information on wealth. And one of the recommendations, if I remember, was that we should start getting SARS to prepare to start collecting that type of information. Of course, the fact that SARS was in such a poor state also means that they don't have the admin capacity that they had. And I think the question that was asked was, when are we going to get the skills that were gone, etc.? You know, our labor legislation works in a particular way. If people have left, we still have to have a competitive process. But hopefully the acting commissioner, I think, can produce some sort of plan, because I know that when the deputy minister and so on has engaged with them, the issue is, how can you build your capacity even now? And sort of some of the valuable skills that were lost, you know, can we get such skills back in some way, either by getting the same people or people of similar skills, obviously operating within what the laws allow. So certainly the commissioner was asked to deal with those issues. Is there anything else on the revenue side that I've missed, Chris, if you want to add on?
Yeah, maybe a couple of things. Yes, thanks. I mean, on that VAT refund, you know, the market, everybody saw and the revenues looked really good. And then what nobody could see was that the credit book in year had gone up by about 7 billion. And so, in effect, the revenues numbers looked 7 billion better. And then that was all they had to go on. They see those monthly receipts. So that's why, in effect, it was such a shock to everybody. And then that's why, going forward, we're trying to pay it out as much as we can. So there won't be any types of these shocks going forward. That's the plan. There were some questions on, you know, what measures would you have in mind. I think just from a general point of view, honourable member, we can't implement new policies to raise revenue immediately. We have to do rate changes. So in our forecast, we assume that we increase the brackets on the personal income tax side by inflation, and we've got certain levels of rates on personal income tax, on VAT, on excise duties, fuel levies, etc. To get revenue immediately, if you're in trouble, we can only change those rates and those brackets. We can't introduce new taxes to solve short-term problems. So those are the things that we look at. And in the previous years, we've increased dividends, withholding tax, capital gains tax, all the fees, etc. And there was a question on under collection, I think Mohamed answered. Just the one point on, do we take all recommendations into account? And, you know, we get proposals to say, you know, as from ARTA itself, taxes are too high, we've gone past the Laffer curve. But then we've got other people responding and putting proposals straight after that saying taxes are too low, taxes must go up. So just because we don't do a certain recommendation doesn't mean that we haven't listened and we aren't thinking about it. But we get opposing requests all the time, and we do think about it and we do try and take it into account. I think that covers most of the points. Actually, just one last thing on the VAT refund. If you look at the December 26th data, there was that huge drop-off in VAT refunds. And we did ask questions as Treasury. We said, why has this dropped off in December 2016? And then we spoke with SARS, and that was the numbers you could see. And then in January 2017, there was a huge increase in VAT refunds that were paid out. So they had said, you know, we've sorted out this issue in that two-monthly period. What we didn't appreciate as Treasury was that there was a bigger underlying level of higher amounts of VAT refunds that should be paid out, which we didn't recognize until recently.
You done?
I can tell you, Chair, just on that, you know, Minister Gordon, when he was Minister, calling them in and asking very hard questions, okay, I was quite impressed with his depth of knowledge as an ex-commissioner. Because we sit in Treasury now, Ivory Tower, we don't know how they actually collect and so on. But, you know, I'm saying in spite of that, this thing was really baked into the system. You even realize the people who are doing this then are so used to doing it, or they don't know why they're doing it, okay, low down, that you've got to go right to the top to know. And I promise you there's no memos that are written to instruct people to do it. This stuff gets often implemented, you know, maybe it's done verbally, but we can't find any hard evidence. But let's see what Judge Noonan comes up with.
You want more transparency within Albania?
Thank you, Chair. Just two quick follow-ups. I'm still a little bit unclear about government's position on SAA. I'm just joking, Mama. I think you did the best that you could under the circumstances.
That question must be posed to the Minister, not the King.
Well, perhaps we could call the Deputy Minister to clarify. My actual point was, I asked him if he would just comment on, we've spoken at length about national debt or the debt, general government debt. I asked him if he'd just comment on SOE debt, which seems to me almost a hidden risk, at least from a broad public perspective. Thank you.
Okay, yes, Treasury. Very briefly, the biggest risk to the framework are the state-owned companies. The biggest risk of the state-owned companies is Eskom. If you just, that's why, just given their size, given the fact that that's the single largest government guarantee, 350 billion rand guarantee facility, we noted two elements in the MTBPS. The first is that over the next 3 years, state-owned companies have to redeem 66 billion rand a year in debt. And a big share of that is foreign, as has been noted already by Honorable Menir. And several of those entities are going to be in a very tight spot. They've got severe cash flow issues already, and it's kind of dependent on their medium-term turnaround strategies and how much revenue they anticipate to bring in. It's also dependent on, so when I say redeem, obviously they can either redeem it or they need to roll it over. So the other way that they can deal with this is that their creditors continue to roll over the existing stock of debt. So just to be clear, this is a major risk, fiscal risk, and even SAA that has now received funding in the current year and last year, 10 billion and 5 billion, have significant debt redemptions coming up in the next 6 months that could put the framework under pressure if the debt is not rolled over. So, you know, we know this is an issue. We keep saying it. In the medium-term framework, there is no additional funding. Currently, for SAA, for example, and unless reforms and steps are taken, this is going to continue to be a difficult issue for the framework, and the likelihood is that these entities will come back to the framework, to the fiscus in future, asking for additional support. So that's why we say again, we're at a crossroads on a whole host of issues, but around ESCOM and the other major state-owned companies, I think this is probably the major risk and the major area of focus, or should be, over the coming year.
Done. Thank you. Thank you to Treasury, thank you honourable members, thank you to our stakeholders that attended this morning. This is part of your public participation. That brings us to the end of this meeting. Honourable members, we will reconvene on Tuesday morning 9:30 as announced by co-chair Karim, and the staff will tell you in which venue where we will consider the report of the two committees, but the two committees will vote separately on the fiscal framework, revised fiscal framework report. Are there any other announcements by you, Chair?
One critical matter. Now, in terms of the existing Money Bills Act, we have to have two reports, right? For all the years since 2009 until last year, we did a single report. Because we don't have capacity, and it means like we've got to do an overview of the same stakeholders. So last year, because the DA insisted, because the Money Bills Act required us to find, we'll separate the two reports, right? Now, they're about to vote in the House on it on Tuesday. When it's going to the House, it's your
soon as possible.
Yeah. So it's about to be concluded where the committee has a choice. It just moves the resolution to say we have one report in some cases, two reports where necessary. But obviously the DA might object and all that. So, yeah, so we can do two reports. It's meaningless in the context of